Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I think we might get started. I know there are a few more folks at least scheduled to come, but good afternoon. I'm Stephen Flanagan, holder of the Kissinger Chair here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to this, our third in a series of seminars here at CSIS on what we're calling the nexus of relations between Turkey, Russia, and Iran, both among those three countries themselves, but particularly how they're playing out in several key regions and the implications of that for U.S. interests. Today, my colleagues, as you know, are going to offer perspectives on the interests and strategies of these three countries and how they're likely to play out in Central Asia, looking particularly to the post-2014 period and following the withdrawal of U.S. and ISAF forces from Afghanistan. And want to explore how these three countries are likely to pursue their differing interests and also touch on how they may deal with other powers who are, of course, vying for influence in this region. The announcement, of course, last week by Presidents Obama and Karzai of the accelerated transition in Afghanistan to an Afghan lead in providing for security through much of the country has, of course, refocused attention on Central Asian developments. ISAF, the International Security Assistance Force, shifting to a combat advisory role in the spring, and U.S. forces withdrawing from Afghan villages, halting most unilateral operations. And, of course, the somewhat unanswered question of not only what size, but whether or if there will be a post-2014 NATO presence to train, advise, and assist the Afghan forces. But beyond Afghanistan, which we'll certainly touch on today, are also the additional concerns about the potential challenges elsewhere in the region. The developments as a result of weak governance, extremist groups, and transnational crime that have led many to look to the region as a potential area of crisis and explosion that could rise up to surprise a number of countries. And indeed, I think some of you may have seen the International Crisis Group in its reports for 2013 had flagged Central Asia as one of the 10 conflicts to watch in the coming year, with a laundry list, as a laundry list of countries on the brink, as Louise Arbour put it in an article in foreignpolicy.com. So we thought it was, as we've been thinking, it's been timely to come back to this. We've been doing some thinking about how these three power players in Eurasia are playing out their interests, but obviously there's growing wider concerns in a number of other countries that we need to touch on. This seminar, for those of you who are coming for the first time, is an outgrowth of a collaborative research project undertaken by several of the folks at this table and some others who aren't here today, looking at this nexus of relations between Turkey, Russia, and Iran. And our thesis is that this complex web of competition and some limited cooperation among these three countries in economic, energy, political, and security affairs is having a major impact on the developments in key regions, particularly the Eastern Mediterranean, the Caucasus, and today we'll touch on Central Asia. We have another seminar coming up at the end of February. We're still not sure whether we'll focus on energy or perhaps have an Iranian focus presentation, and then we'll have our final report of the group in March. But let me briefly introduce the speakers today, and two of which are members of this project team on Turkey, Russia, Iran, and I'll introduce them in the order in the order in which they'll speak, and then we'll have time for I'm sure a very interesting discussion given the well-informed group I see assembled around this table and on the outer chairs. First of all, our first speaker will be Dr. Anthony Cordesman, who's, of course, the Burt Chair in Strategy here, has written much about Iranian strategy and forces and developments throughout the Southwest Asia region, and, of course, has been doing a lot of work on Afghanistan over the last decade and longer. And then Dr. Jeff Mankoff, who's Deputy Director and Senior Fellow in the Russia-Eurasia Program, who has been doing a great deal of work on Central Asia and focusing in particular in the context of our Turkey-Russia-Iran project of a paper on Turkey's interests and strategy in Central Asia. And last but not least, certainly Dr. Andrew Cutchins, Director and Senior Fellow of the Russia-Eurasia Program here, who, of course, has done a great deal of thinking about both Central Asia and, of course, Russian strategy more broadly and in this region and other key areas of the world, and, of course, also the competition with the other player we're not mentioning per se, but I'm sure we'll talk about in Central Asia, but China. So I'll ask Tony and Jeff to speak first in that order for about 10 minutes and to provide some of the key findings that they've had and some analysis they've done on Iranian and then Turkish interests. And then Andy will offer perspectives on Russia's key interests and how Moscow is viewing these potential interlopers, I guess, in its desired sphere of influence and near abroad. In looking at how this might play out, and that should leave a good time for discussion with this audience, which I really look forward to. So, Tony, the floor is yours.
Let me really begin with.
And let me just say we are this is being recorded for a web podcast for the people who aren't able to join us today.
Let me begin with Afghanistan. I think that. Even in my earlier visits to Afghanistan during the war, it was surprising to see how far Iranian influence could extend and the strange places it would show up, even in parts of eastern Afghanistan. You would find them working with Hazaras, you would find Iranian aid workers in the field. You saw them build up communications networks. You saw them begin to sponsor broadcast and TV stations. And you saw a growing presence in the northwestern part of Afghanistan with links not simply, as you might expect, to the Shiite Hazara, but to a variety of other groups, building up ties there. And most of this seemed to be a matter of both obvious geographic self-interest and, in some ways, guarding themselves against renewal of the problems that had occurred when the Taliban came to power. And when we did this study, my initial reaction was that Iran would be a problem in Afghanistan only if we had a major crisis in the Gulf where we conducted something on the order of preventive strikes. I would have to say that in timing, the risk of some incident in the Gulf potentially escalating seemed to be more critical than the risk of preventive strikes. But talking to senior Afghan officials, they have a different perspective on this and one that's continued to change. It is basically that Iran has begun to use these contacts not simply to try to strengthen its role in Afghanistan, create trade routes and entry into Turkmenistan and elsewhere to buffer itself against narcotics coming out of Afghanistan, but also to create more serious contingency capabilities potentially to use against the United States if there is some military clash. And the fact that senior Afghan officials take this seriously is something which I would really raise as an important issue. It's difficult to know. It's very easy to find worst case and best case scenarios here. It's also a fact that if things go wrong in transition, Iran and the United States, in many ways, go back to having an obvious common interest. They would like to see as much stability in Afghanistan as possible. And if something like the new Northern Alliance becomes a factor, or if you see a division inside of Afghanistan, with perhaps Taliban and insurgent influence growing in the east and in the south, the question of how much Iran would really care to push against the United States, whose continued presence would help stabilize the country and help protect Iran, is uncertain. Looking at the economic and trade and energy side, there's always this possibility of having some kind of major increase in energy, economic, and other trade. There's always the possibility that Iran might want to expand its trade relations somehow to get around sanctions. And there are some indications of this in the Central Asian countries. There's the whole idea that it could somehow build up a major trade route from its port outside the strait, inside the Gulf of Oman. There is an effort to build up road and rail nets, which would go through potentially part of Afghanistan, improve its flow or access to Turkmenistan, although it already has that through Mashhad, and also improve its ability to move into western Afghanistan. However, having been there in Iran when I was there with the embassy and having been there in Afghanistan, I give you a caution. Western Iran is not the central focus of Iran. Talking about major trade routes or any major flow through this area is a lot more difficult than it seems. There really isn't very much in most of Western Afghanistan. There are serious problems basically in terms of changes in water flow, problems really with agriculture. It's not an area of increasing development. You can talk about some indicators, but frankly, it's very difficult to see what Iran can get out of most of Western Afghanistan. It's very difficult to see what anyone can get out of it. You have to move north into the areas that are much closer to Central Asia. And these are areas which are ethnically ones which are more aligned to the Central Asian states. I think as you look across this, Turkmenistan is obviously an important trading partner. But when you say that it provides something on the order of about 7% of Iran's gas, and you look at the volume of trade, again, compared to Iran's other trading interests and economic interests, it's limited. As you look at the rest of Iranian influence in Central Asia, you see some projects where Iran has obviously tried to gain visibility. It's rather surprising that you see energy investments in places like Uzbekistan and so on. But again, all you have to do is look at the geography and realize these areas are much more a matter of influence for Russia, for China, for trade with other states. How far can Iran go in the near future? What will its motivations be? I really think that depends far more on what happens outside of this region than in it. If we find ourselves in any truly serious military contingency with Iran, it may choose to act out in spite of the other problems in transition. But I think that Iranians, frankly, are going to be a lot more realistic about the risks in transition than we tend to be officially. There is still sort of the official posture in ISAF and in the US that things are going considerably better in Afghanistan than they really are. I don't think Iran has any of those illusions. And I don't think a lot of Afghans have those illusions. There's a very real risk that transition may be, even with the election that's supposed to come up in 2014, a very problematic issue. We may or may not be able to stay in Afghanistan. And if we do stay in Afghanistan, I think a lot of Iran's concerns that the United States might use this as a springboard against Iran are going to be cut simply by the limits to the U.S. presence that remains. It won't, if we go on with our current plans, be a zero option, although I think the zero option is at least a possibility. But having a few bases which are going to have very limited capabilities, be focused on providing enablers and trainers for Afghanistan, is going to be much less of an apparent threat to Iran at a time when I think Iran is going to be far more concerned about Afghanistan as a potential threat to Iran. And beyond that, is it really going to build up major new trading routes? with Turkmenistan, I doubt it. Is it going to really go to a serious trading relationship with Uzbekistan? There is the fact that Uzbekistan is depending on Iran as a transshipment point for a lot of its cotton. About 60-70% moves through Bandar Abbas. But why that actually creates a strategic relationship is a lot more problematic. Tajikistan, again, I'm just struggling. It has another set of investments in electric power, but it's hard to give that particularly serious weight. And in Kyrgyzstan, the trade rate is with so low that Iran's goal is to boost trade to $1 billion at some indefinite point in the future. That kind of goal is kind of typical, that everyone would like to have a major role in Central Asia if they can only figure out how to make it work and make it practical. And I think basically, let me leave it at that.
Yeah, that's a good coda. Thank you. Thank you, Tang. Jeff Manko.
Thank you. In terms of Turkey's role and participation in Central Asia and Afghanistan, I think there's a slight paradox, which is that on the ground, particularly in Central Asia, Turkey is very visible. Yet, as a strategic player, in terms of the impact of Turkey's presence on its relationship with outside powers, particularly Russia and Iran, Central Asia is not an especially important component of those bilateral and multilateral relationships. And so I want to talk a little bit about what I see as being the reasons for that, perhaps paradox. Turkey has certainly been a very visible participant, both in Afghanistan and in Central Asia, since the start of operations in 2001. And in looking at the role that Ankara will play in the region after the withdrawal of foreign forces in 2014, I would point really to three areas where I think the emphasis is really going to lie. One has to do with advancing Turkey's regional ambitions, primarily both in Central Asia and Afghanistan, primarily in regions of promoting stability, reform, and developing energy resources that can benefit Turkey itself as well as the local economies. Secondly, promoting the economic interests of Turkish companies, which play a very significant role in Ankara's engagement, particularly in the five countries of Central Asia. And then third is reinforcing Turkey's role as a NATO member and a partner of the United States, which has been, I would argue, an underappreciated component of the reasons for Turkey's participation and the mechanisms by which Turkey has participated in the conflict in Afghanistan. And I think going forward after 2014, the pursuit of these interests, much more than any kind of strategic balancing against either Russia or Iran, will be the foundation posts of Turkey's presence in the region. At the same time, though, a word of caution is in order, which has to do with the situation closer to Turkey's borders. Even though Turkish politicians across the political spectrum emphasize their interest in remaining engaged in Afghanistan and in Central Asia after 2014, the fact remains that resources are limited and the neighborhood around Turkey's borders is becoming increasingly problematic, as we've seen with the crisis in Syria and the potential for some kind of military conflict involving Iran, the question of the Kurds, the potential for violence in the Caucasus and the like. As a result, all of these areas are closer to Turkey's borders, are higher priority in terms of Turkish security interests, and therefore may well come to overshadow any participation or any overt Turkish role in Afghanistan and Central Asia in the years to come. I'd like to talk a little bit about what role Turkey has played both in Afghanistan and in Central Asia, and then what the implications of this participation are for Turkey's relationship with both Russia and Iran, since we're talking about the strategic nexus of relations between those three powers. It's important to point out at the beginning, I think, that, and this was emphasized to me by many Turkish officials, that they view Afghanistan and Central Asia through largely different lenses. That the type of engagement they are seeking in Central Asia and in Afghanistan is in many ways different. In Central Asia, there's a much stronger economic component, there's a stronger cultural component, in part given the shared culture and historical ties between the two countries. But at the same time, a recognition that the secular political culture in Central Asia does not offer fertile ground for the activities of religious groups, which are much more active, for example, in Afghanistan. since 9/11, I would argue that Turkey's role in the broader region has been driven by a complex set of calculations that include the worldview that the AK Party government has developed of establishing Turkey as a pivotal state in the world at large, and particularly between the West and the Muslim world, seeking to leverage its Muslim identity as well as its membership in NATO and the broader Western community to play a coordinating and at times pivotal role in both Central Asia and in Afghanistan. More broadly, seeking to prove Turkey's value as a NATO partner and increase perceptions, particularly in the United States, of Turkey's value as a partner and an ally within NATO, especially given the concerns about the security situation within Turkey's own region. This alliance relationship remains the keystone of Turkish security, and therefore is, I would argue, going to become increasingly important in the years to come. And participation in NATO's operations in and around Afghanistan has allowed Turkey to re-emphasize the importance of that relationship. That said, the most visible and substantive Turkish role, particularly in Central Asia, is played less by the government than by Turkish companies and non-governmental organizations, including the Gulen movement, which has been very prominent in cultural and educational activities across the broader region. Certainly, in a lot of ways, these efforts coincide with the interests of the Turkish government and are promoted and facilitated by official engagement, but they operate separately from state policy as well. In terms of Afghanistan, Turkey has played a very prominent role, has at different times had up to 1,800 troops present in the ISAF coalition. It's important to note, however, that these troops have been restricted to non-combat roles in large part because of domestic opposition to the presence of these troops, particularly in a war zone. Turkish officials have emphasized repeatedly that their troops will be the last ones to leave Afghanistan, emphasizing the commitment that they have to reconstruction and promoting stability in the region. Turkey's played a very important role in providing training for Afghan police and security forces, as well as for civilian officials. This has taken place both on the ground in Afghanistan and back in Turkey. Turkey has headed provincial reconstruction teams in two provinces. Turkish general has commanded ISAF on two occasions, and has also headed several regional commands, including the Kabul Regional Command. In the broader region, Turkey's also played an important diplomatic role in trying to promote broader cooperation on an Afghan political settlement. These include trilateral summits with the leaders of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and the so-called Istanbul process, where Turkey has sought to get buy-in from the Central Asian neighbors for a political transition in Afghanistan. The region has been a major focus of reconstruction aid, with more than $100 million in 2011 being targeted to South and Central Asia. An important element in all of this, of course, is also Turkey's partnership with Pakistan, which is not discussed quite as often. Given the difficult relations between Pakistan and many of the NATO partners, particularly the United States, Turkey argues that it has a special role to play here in facilitating cooperation with Pakistan, that it has a certain legitimacy in Islamabad that the West otherwise lacks, and emphasizes ties that have existed dating back to the Cold War era. And this is, I think, part of the foundation for Turkey's participation in this trilateral process with Afghanistan and Pakistan. Despite all of this, and despite the frequently stated commitment of the Turkish government to remain engaged in Afghanistan, after 2014, when I spoke with Turkish officials, I got a lot of pessimism about Afghanistan's post-2014 future, as Dr. Cordesman just pointed out. And partially as a result, I think there's been a certain amount of hedging in terms of engaging alternate actors in case the Karzai government should fall. Certainly in the 1990s, Turkey had very strong relations with some of the non-Pashtun movements and warlords in the north of Afghanistan, including the Uzbek Abdul Rashid Dostum. It was emphasized to me on several occasions that today Turkey is seeking to diversify its relationships in this part of Afghanistan, not relying specifically on Dostum, who's been a very difficult customer, but seeking rather to build relations more broadly with particularly the Uzbek and Turkmen communities in northern Afghanistan in order to have a hedge in the event that stability proves fleeting after 2014. In terms of Central Asia, Turkey's main interests, I would argue, are largely economic. At the same time, of course, there are strategic interests that have to do with maintaining the region's autonomy promoting reform and liberalization, which Turkish officials argue in the long term is the key to to Central Asia's long-term political stability, and in the longer term as well to developing energy and economic resources for transit to Turkey. And this is one area where there is a certain amount of rivalry with Iran and particularly with Russia. Turkey has argued that it should be the long-term energy bridge between the Caspian region and Europe. At the same time, by developing these energy resources, Turkey would be able to lessen its dependence on both Russia and Iran for oil and gas imports. Right now, between Russia and Iran, between them combined for providing well over 3/4 of Turkey's oil and gas imports. Economic ties with Central Asia are very extensive. As I said, South and Central Asia has been the number one target for Turkish reconstruction aid. Turkey is also the top export market for companies in Tajikistan, and number two for companies in Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan. Turkish construction companies are present across the region. If you look at cities like Almaty, Ashgabat, where significant amounts of new construction have taken place in recent years, the vast majority of that is being undertaken by Turkish companies. Mm-hmm. Within Central Asia, there's, I think, an appreciation for the role that these Turkish companies play, particularly given that they have an ability and a willingness to operate not only in the difficult political environment of Central Asia, but also in areas outside of the capitals where many other Western companies are not widely represented. At the same time, especially since the AK Party government has come to power, there's been a very close, almost symbiotic relationship between the Turkish business community and the Turkish state. And so, therefore, the government plays an active role in facilitating some of these economic relationships. And once the conflict in Afghanistan is no longer driving Turkish engagement with Central Asia, it's these economic relationships, I think, that are going to really lay the foundation for Ankara's continued influence in the region. Cultural influence is also strong, especially in the Turkic-speaking countries, which is to say the Central Asian countries other than Tajikistan. Most international flights into the region go through Turkey. Turkey plays a very active role in education. There are a number of Turkish schools, both government and private, including those sponsored by the Gulen movement. Turkish newspapers are translated into regional languages. And several of the Central Asian leaders, particularly Nursultan Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan and Almazbek Atambayev in Kyrgyzstan, have very strong personal ties to Turkey, including residences, and have spent significant amounts of time in Turkey. I'd like to say just a brief word about the Gulen movement. We can talk more about this during Q&A. This, as many of you know, is a private cultural and religious movement, promotes a variety of Sufi-inspired Islam coupled with a kind of common Turkish culture. It has had a very complex relationship with the Turkish state, including the AK Party government, but at least in Central Asia, the aims of the movement and the government seem to largely coincide. The government has been supportive of the Gulen movement's educational initiatives. It sponsors a number of schools and universities across Central Asia, 5 universities at least, and has close ties with the Federation of Independent Businessmen of Turkey, TUSKAN, which is the most active of Turkey's chambers of commerce and deals in Central Asia. We can talk a little more about the movement during Q&A. It hasn't always been welcomed in Central Asia. It's had problems mainly in Uzbekistan, but there are suspicions as well, and this is a potential source of longer-term tensions. Just very briefly about relations with Russia and Iran. When Turkey first became a major player in Central Asia in the early 1990s, its presence was predicated on acting as a counterweight to both Russian and Iranian influence, and this was a role in which it was encouraged very heavily by the United States, promoting the Turkish model of secular and democratic development as an alternative either to Russian-style authoritarianism or Iranian-style theocracy. That experiment did not go especially well, and by the mid-1990s, Turkey had pulled back from it. To the extent that Turkey is a major player in the region today, it is being much more cautious about antagonizing either Russia or Iran, especially Russia. Over the past decade, there's been a wide-ranging rapprochement between Ankara and Moscow, notwithstanding the tensions over Syria. They have, I would argue, largely overlapping worldviews about the nature of the emerging global order. I've already spoken about their energy ties. Russia is Turkey's largest trading partner. Most of that is energy. Additionally, about 100,000 Russians a year travel to Turkey. There's now visa-free travel for tourists, so there's a very high degree of economic and cultural integration here. At the same time, Turkish officials argue that as they learned in the 1990s, Turkey simply cannot match Russia's interests or the amount of resources that Russia has available for Central Asia. And so it's counterproductive in some ways for Turkey to get into a kind of balance of power relationship with Moscow. Rather, the emphasis is on cultural and economic opportunities that are not seen as counter to Russian interests. There is some wariness of Russian-led integration projects like the Customs Union and the Eurasian Union, but at the same time, a recognition that these initiatives offer opportunities for Turkish companies. For example, if they can invest in Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan and then have access to Russian markets. There's some tension with Russia over democratization, especially in places like Uzbekistan, where there's a concern that democratization, Turkish style, equates with Islamization. Energy, of course, is a big issue and one that we can talk about more. In terms of Iran, yes, there has been the development of a kind of strategic rivalry between Tehran and Ankara over the last several years. But one of the interesting elements of all of this is that that rivalry has been largely absent from Central Asia. Yes, Turkey would like to limit Iran's ability to create disorder or political change in Central Asia, but at the same time, this is an area that's a lower priority than the Middle East, the Caucasus, or other areas closer to Turkish borders. There has been some spillover of the Turkish-Iranian rivalry, certainly in Azerbaijan, but there's very much less of it in Central Asia. So what does all of this mean for 2014? Well, Turkey wants to remain engaged. It wants to uphold its commitment to Afghanistan and reinforce its value to NATO and the United States, as I mentioned. But given the constraints that Turkey faces, I think the role that it is going to play is likely going to shift more to one of facilitation, business development, and cultural cooperation. Push for political change, but only insofar as doing so doesn't affect business interests and doesn't affect stability. Yes, Turkey wants stability in the region, but given the constraints that it faces and the problems closer to home, I think there's a real question about how many resources and what kind of commitment it actually has and will be able to make to Central Asia after 2014.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Jeff. Any questions?
Thanks, Steve. Let me try to be brief, do the job, and get out. Which is pretty much what the Russians want to see us do in Afghanistan. Do the job and get out as quickly as possible. I'm going to make a couple of historical points that I think hopefully illustrate some enduring interests and perceptions that Russia has of Central Asia and, to a lesser extent, Afghanistan, more so Central Asia. So first of all, let's go back to the collapse of the Soviet Union and recall that it was the Belavezhka Accord between Belarus, Ukraine, and the Russian Federation, which was essentially the catalyzing event for the collapse of the Soviet Union. There were no Central Asian leaders represented there. Mr. Nazarbayev was particularly peeved and unhappy about that. Now, subsequently, of course, as this accord kind of expanded into the Commonwealth of International States, the CIS, the Central Asians came in. This came later. But I recall traveling several times in Russia, and one long trip throughout the entire Soviet Union in the fall of 1990, September of 1990, as things were really starting to unwind. I was lecturing for a University of California Alumni Association tour that went all over the place, including Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. And essentially, what I got from talking to Russian elites is that their view of Central Asia was, this is a cost to us. We're not that interested in really maintaining this part of the empire, so to speak. And particularly for Russian liberals, the liberal reformers, not only was this a cost to us, but the Central Asian states, they needed to get needed to be a velvet divorce because they would be an obstacle to reform within the Russian Federation. The popular idea at that time in 1990 was Alexander Solzhenitsyn's idea of the kind of Slavic Union, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and northern Kazakhstan, where the Slavic and particularly Russian populations are the largest. I don't think this view of Central Asia on the part of Moscow has really fundamentally changed. To the extent that the Russians want integration with Central Asia, I think both in economic terms and in security terms, they want it to be relatively cost-free. They're not ready to spend very much for this. I think this is very much true regarding the customs union. It's supposed to be the embryo for the Eurasian Union. Mr. Putin has talked about. I mean, currently includes only Belarus, Russia, and Kazakhstan. Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan are interested in joining. They probably will eventually join, but I think there are no illusions in Moscow about the particular value that them joining the customs union will add. Now, Ukraine is a different matter. That is really the goal behind the customs union, is for the integration with Ukraine for both political and economic reasons. But Central Asia, not so much from the standpoint of Moscow. And for in Central Asia, I think the interests of the Central Asian states, to the extent that it exists, and Uzbekistan has been quite clear that they are not interested in this at all. In fact, they're not interested in any integration institution with Moscow at the moment. That can always change. But there's an incentive for the customs union as a way to kind of manage the growing economic power of China in the region. And certainly this is a concern for Russia, at least in the Russian Federation, in the Russian Far East and Eastern Siberia. It's a concern there. Strangely, the Russians have not seemed to evince so much concern about the dramatically growing economic influence that China has in Central Asia, first and foremost, but all throughout the so-called post-Soviet space. But I think that's a factor. Now, with Ukraine, it's very different. I mean, there it's basically Western integration, EU, or customs union, Russia. And that's a different matter. And even from a security standpoint, where the Russians have made more efforts, particularly in recent years, to beef up the security presence and capabilities in Central Asia to some extent, recently signing the long-term accord with Tajikistan, extending their military presence there, as well as improving the capacities of rapid reaction forces in the region, which are principally constituted of Kazakh and Russian forces. But even there, I mean, there's a lot of ambivalence. I mean, look at what happened in 2010 in Kyrgyzstan in response to the civil unrest. The new government, led by Roza Otunbayeva, were requesting military support from Russia. It was not forthcoming. The Russians didn't think it was essentially worth the blood or the treasure. The other larger point I would make is that the Russians are increasingly aware, as others, that it's not so much of a Russian-Western competition conflict in Central Asia, but it's much more of a multipolar environment where there are more players. China is the obvious big one, but India, Iran, Turkey, and others play significant roles. And they also understand that it's basically what drives the integration are economic forces, and to a greater extent, these are market economic forces, I would submit. Okay, second historical point is 9/11. Now, frequently cited is the famous phone call that Vladimir Putin made to George W. Bush, the first international leader to call Mr. Bush and express his deep sympathies for what had happened, which I think were genuine. but then, of course, we remember that the Russians supported the U.S. military presence in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan. But that wasn't the first inclination. The first inclination was to send an envoy to the region, Sergei Ivanov, who went to at least Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan to try to talk the leaders there, Akayev in Kyrgyzstan and Karimov in Uzbekistan, not to allow for an American military presence in the region. But Akayev and Karimov went their own way, and when Putin realized that this is what was going to happen, he essentially made a silk purse out of a sow's ear, and you know, acquiesced and approved the U.S. military presence in Central Asia. Now, look, he could have done a lot of things to prevent this and made things very, very difficult for us if he so chose. But I think the point I want to make is that there's really a deep and fundamental ambivalence on the part of Moscow about our military presence in Central Asia that endures to this day. You know, I remember Grisha Yavlinsky. Remember him? Liberal political leader, head of the Yabloko Party. He came to Washington later in the fall of 2001, and he told the story of the meeting that Putin had with 22 or 24 kind of elite figures, and everybody, with the exception of himself, Yavlinsky, and one other, might have been Chubais, I don't recall. I don't think he mentioned it. He certainly wouldn't want to mention Chubais because they hated each other. But only two people in the room supported a U.S. military presence in Central Asia, or supported having the Russians essentially be in league with us in the Afghan endeavor. And you know, this maybe shouldn't be so surprising. You got to think that, you know, for most of the Russian elite, the current elite, you know, the generation, these are baby boomers. You know, they basically grew up in the Soviet Union. Especially for the military elite, a lot of these guys were actually fighting in Afghanistan in the 1980s against forces that were supported by the United States, and had the experience of what the Afghan war contributed, not the main factor, but contributed to the eventual collapse of the Soviet Union. So another factor, kind of an emotional, psychological factor behind the ambivalence. But the prevailing view then was that the USA was essentially, in taking down the Taliban, was doing a job that the Russians would want to do themselves, they didn't have the capacity to do. So it's a good thing. This is in Russian national security interests. And in fact, that the Russians had wanted to do this for quite a while. They'd approached the Clinton administration in 1999 about conducting a unilateral Russian attack on some of the bases in Afghanistan. We turned them down. This was in the context of the Armitage Trubnikov anti-terrorism working group. And to a certain extent, the Russian response to 9/11 was, we told you so. You know, you knuckleheads have been all fired up about missile defense as kind of the lead, you know, the lead on your national security, when the biggest danger to your interests, as well as our interests, are these forces, these Islamist, fundamentalist, terrorist forces that are based in camps in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. Okay, but still there's the ambivalence. Do the job and get out. And it's similar to the Chinese position. Although the Chinese really have a hard time believing that we have been in Afghanistan, and we extended this presence in Afghanistan for more than 10 years to take out terrorist forces. I mean, they think this is really all about an effort to contain China. This is to have a military presence in China's strategic rear. And I remember very well a couple of years ago, Tony was making a presentation on Afghanistan to a group of, it was a China-Russia-U.S. trilateral meeting. And the Chinese representative had made a strong argument that we're in Afghanistan to contain China. And Tony said, the large American military presence in Afghanistan is the best thing that you could wish for. Essentially, something along, I paraphrase. Okay. Now, the Russians have wanted, and particularly in the last few years, when we were trying to set up the Northern Distribution Network, the new transit corridors into Afghanistan, which they ultimately supported, you know, they wanted the United States, NATO, to work with not Central Asian countries bilaterally, but they wanted to work with the CSTO. And that was just a no-go zone for the U.S. government for a number of reasons. First of all, there's the question of, well, probably the first question is that the perception that the CSTO is basically an institution promoting Russian military hegemony in the region, et cetera. Secondly, I think there are real questions about what are the capabilities of the CSTO. The third biggest problem with the CSTO is that there's the disunity within the CSTO. Uzbekistan, particularly going back to 2009 and the discussions about the Northern Distribution Network, were adamantly opposed to extending Russian military presence in Central Asia. I remember a trip to Tashkent, talking with the Uzbek leaders, very high-level leaders, and their point was that basically the Russian goal in Central Asia is to increase insecurity as a justification for an increase in a Russian military presence. And that essentially, when it comes to Central Asia and Afghanistan, that Iran has interests closer to those of Washington than the Russian Federation. So disunity has been a problem there. Okay, finally, just a couple of words about Turkey and Iran in the region. I think that Tony and Jeff covered this essentially. In the 1990s, there was some concern on the part of Russia about the ambitions that Turkey and Iran had in Central Asia. But the Russian perception of Turkey and Iran was quite different at that time. And it was much more positive of Iran. One, of course, the Russians and the Iranians and the Indians had been supporting, maybe not in a coordinated way, supporting the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan before 2001. I'm going to wrap this up in just a second, Steve. Two, there was the Russian and Iranian, eventually the Iranian support with the Russians to conclude the civil war in Tajikistan. To make it long story short, the Russians have been more inclined to view Iran and Afghanistan and Central Asia and elsewhere as more of a strategic partner, and have more concern about Turkey and the kinds of Islamic forces that Turkey supports. This is especially true in the 1990s, because before the rapprochement that Jeff referred to, the remarkable rapprochement of Turkish-Russian relations that's taken place over the last 10, 12 years, under the leaderships of Erdogan and Putin, what was happening in the 1990s was essentially Russians were supporting Kurdish groups and institutions, and Turks were supporting Chechen opposition forces, secessionists. And it was the mutual agreement to cease those activities on the part of Ankara and Moscow that really was a major facilitating factor leading to the rapprochement, which was then took off on an economic momentum of its own that Jeff talked about. But these, when we look at the differences over Syria today and the so-called Arab Spring, is again Moscow. Moscow looks at Erdogan in particular, personally, somewhat warily, as to just how much of an Islamist is this guy. And I think in particular when Moscow, where we see in Syria, where Moscow and Ankara's interests are diametrically opposed, and Moscow sees some of the groups that are being supported as part of the Syrian opposition, this re-raises some of those concerns that Moscow has had about the kinds of Islamic forces that Ankara is inclined to support. Final word is that in the context of the U.S.-Russia relationship, 4 years ago, in talking to lots of Russians with the coming in of the Obama administration, they felt at the time that Afghanistan was still, despite some of the ambivalence and somewhat, there was not a full coincidence of interest, that this was the most promising area for U.S.-Russian cooperation. And I think today, while once again the relationship is in a very bad place, maybe not as bad as it was at the end of 2008, early 2009, after the Georgia War, but still the overlap of interests in Afghanistan is significant, and it's going to be very important, I think, for the Obama administration to clarify to the Russians in particular, you know, what the plans are there and how, and there may be some potential for working with the certain capacities and relationships that the Russians have there. I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Okay, well, thank you all very much. Many threads that we could pick up in that rich discussion, I'm sure. So we'll open the floor to discussion. We have a little about 35, 37 minutes for discussion. And if you could just flag my attention and just identify yourself, and we'll try to, I'm sure there'll be a number of questions, so try to actually make it a question rather than a speech. I'm sorry, Marvin. Oh, yes, sir. I'm sorry, Marvin Ott, then. Go ahead.
Wasn't expecting to go first, so it's not a well-formulated question, but the role of China in all of this interests me, and it was a kind of slightly off-stage presence in each of the presentations. But I wonder if anybody would like to sort of play out or think through the role that China is going to play in this area vis-a-vis these various other Turkey, Iran, Russia, and so on, over the next decade or so. For example, as an unreconstructed geopolitician, I keep coming back to the potential for a Russian-Chinese sort of fundamental clash of interests in East, in the Siberian, Central Asian area, despite this remarkable collaboration they've had through the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and all that. But anyway, any thoughts on where China fits into all this?
I can start on that one. Happy to. So maybe somewhere fits to China. Yeah. You know, the Chinese interests at the moment in Central Asia and Afghanistan have been principally economic. And the Chinese interests in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization have been primarily economic. And I think that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has been a kind of a useful multilateral forum / cover for to help to manage, from China's standpoint, to help to manage the China's growing economic influence in the region, and to maybe try to help mitigate some of the conflicting interests that they and the Russians would have. Now, the biggest conflict would be over energy, and certainly one of the main goals of Russia for the last 20 years has been to try to maintain, to the extent that it can, a monopoly on both production and transit capacity of hydrocarbon resources, in the former Soviet Union. And they haven't done so well of late, particularly in regard to Central Asia and China. I think Chinese companies have about 40% equity stakes in current Kazakh oil production. And of course, the example of the Turkmen, Central Asian Chinese Turkmen, Uzbek, Kazakh, Chinese pipeline, which, while it's not the first actual break in the Russian monopoly on the transit of gas, was actually a smaller pipeline between Turkmenistan and Iran going back to 1998-1999. But the deal and the pipeline that was completed in 2009 and the potential for expanding that is a significant blow for the Russians' efforts in that regard. Now, the Russians have kind of come to terms with that in that, well, it's better for Turkmen gas to go east or south, if TAPI were to come into play, better for it to go east and south, but not go west. I mean, that they're adamantly opposed to. They're adamantly opposed to the Azeris and the Turkmen coming to an agreement about the Caspian Sea, which would facilitate pipeline going west. Their major market is Europe. They want to guard that to the extent possible. They're not doing a very good job of that either. So
I think, you know, for both, but for both Russia and for China, I mean, Central Asia is a strategic rear. And obviously China's, you know, priorities, as we're seeing playing out right now in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, are there. And China has been more reluctant to, has been willing to kind of cede to Russia military security hegemony in Central Asia. I'm not sure how long that will last. I mean, that could change. The Chinese primary interest is security in Xinjiang province, and so if they see that threats are emerging from Central Asia to Xinjiang, which the Russians and or others are not capable of addressing effectively, then I would think you would see a different posture, Chinese military posture in that regard.
Anybody want to say about SCO, or do you want, Tony, do you want to go ahead?
I think that it was interesting to be in a meeting in Beijing and have the director of the SCO talk about Afghanistan, not Central Asia, and make it absolutely clear that this was the responsibility of the international community. No, the international community, as we all know in the real world, is a synonym for having either someone else or no one else do it. And it was quite clear that this was the general position both of the Chinese and Russian representatives. They simply didn't want to get involved. There have been, for example, Chinese investments in a mine in China, I mean in Afghanistan, nothing has happened. There's a placeholder in an oil field. But one thing you have to remember when we talk about numbers here is the United States has spent $85 billion on aid as part of the Afghan war. So when somebody says they spent a couple of hundred million, no, that's not significant. And when you say you've committed yourself to an investment of several billion, but you don't have any cash flow, that's not very significant either. So it's really important to trace the numbers here, and the numbers don't show a lot of Chinese interest in Afghanistan.
Okay, thanks. Yes, Joe? Oh, did you want to say, quickly?
Maybe just say a really brief word about Turkey. Two things, you know, there is, I think, Turkey and China are not generally strategic competitors, certainly in Central Asia. Yet, I think there are two areas of at least moderate concern. One has to do with economics, and again, given the growth of China's economic influence in Central Asia, because Turkey's interests in the region are primarily economic, or primarily those of Turkish companies, and eventually in the question of getting Central Asian energy transited to the West through Turkey. In that sense, China is something of an economic competitor, and one that is much bigger and potentially could, you know, be the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And the second has to do with this question of Xinjiang. Many of the Uyghur activists who've been expelled from China or exiled from China have moved to Turkey. Given the ethnic and cultural connection, there's a lot of sympathy in Turkey for the Uyghur cause in China, and certainly that's a point of tension. And if the situation in Xinjiang were to get really out of hand, I could see this being an area where there's a kind of enduring tension between Beijing and Ankara. But otherwise, you know, it's not an especially polarized relationship. Turkey actually has recently gotten observer status in the SCO, which, again, seems to be part of this kind of hedging strategy about what the future holds for Afghanistan and a desire to have other options should the Western-led transition process not work out as advertised.
Andy has just a brief word on...
Just a brief word on Iran and China, since you raised it. You know, it's, you know, when Iran and Russia have been doing their double vetoes on Syria and coordinated on other issues in the UN Security Council, it's always Russia that gets all the heat, and China's kind of given a free pass, and often the reasons amongst the reasons cited for the Russians are their economic interests in Iran. Well, you know, the Russian trade with Iran is $3 to $4 billion a year. Chinese trade with Iran is 8 to 10x that. And so this is a far more developed economic and political relationship, I think, between Beijing and Tehran than it is between Moscow and Tehran, where particularly right now there is there's always a deficit of trust in those capitals, but especially now after the decisions that the Russians have made in the last couple of years and on the UN Security Council, as well as the withdrawal of the sale of the S-300 anti-aircraft system.
Okay. System. Yes, the gentleman here, and then Rick Burt had a question. When we pull a couple, maybe there may be some overlap.
Alex Van Os, I focus on the Caucasus at the Foreign Service Institute. I would love to hear a little bit more from Jeffrey Mankoff about this Gulen movement.
Okay. Do we want? Okay.
Are you on this point? You on the Caucasus too, Richard? No. Okay. Thanks. Okay. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, I don't want to get too much into it, but it's a private religious organization founded by a cleric named Fethullah Gulen, who currently lives in Pennsylvania. His supporters played an instrumental role in the rise of the ACK Party, but there's been some tension for a variety of reasons between them, which is one of the reasons he's in Pennsylvania, though Prime Minister Erdogan invited him to come back to Turkey recently. His ideological emphasis has been on a kind of Sufi-inspired, tolerant version of Islam that he portrays as being kind of an alternative to some of the more radical Saudi-influenced strands of Islam that have become more prevalent, including in the post-Soviet region in recent years. There are concerns about the role of his movement in controlling organs of power within the Turkish state. He gave an interview at one point several years ago where he talked about how he wanted his followers to, I think the phrase was, infiltrate the capillaries of power and become a kind of power behind the throne within Turkish politics. And there's been a lot of concern about the role that his followers have played, particularly on the part of the secularists, but increasingly among those within the AK Party government as well, and that's been the source of significant tension. When Erdogan was hospitalized about a year and a half ago, maybe, there was a big scandal over arrests in the Interior Ministry that may have been sparked by followers of Gulen. It was eventually resolved, but there's a concern that despite his the vision of a relatively tolerant form of Islam that he promotes, that nevertheless there's a kind of anti-democratic streak in the movement that he promotes. In Central Asia, their role has been humanitarian and educational. Again, they sponsor schools. They're connected with the business community in most of these countries. Turkish businessmen underwrite the activities of the educational institutions. In some cases, they operate in partnership with the host governments in Central Asia. And the schools are very popular because they offer very high quality education. They offer subjects like computer science and management that are not typically covered in the state schools in places like Turkmenistan. They offer training in the local language, Turkish, Russian, and English. And the students come out multilingual and with a skill set that's typically higher than they could get by participating in local education. And so for that reason, they're very popular. They've been pretty successful at kind of navigating the politics of the kind of post-Soviet secularism in these countries, but it's definitely a source of concern. They've had the most trouble in Uzbekistan, which closed down their schools, arrested several businessmen who it alleged were connected to the Gulen movement, and seized property from several of them, and they haven't been allowed to return to Uzbekistan. But they operate in the other four Central Asian countries, in Russia, and in a lot of other parts of the world as well.
Okay. Lisa, did you want to follow on this question? Or
On the Caucasus, just a question about Azerbaijan, which we haven't spoken much of. Given the sort of challenges for Europe and the U.S. on a potentially enduring crisis with Iran, and preventing spillover from Syria, are we likely to see more of a strategic partnership with the US, the EU, and Azerbaijan? Or do you think Azerbaijan will remain focused mostly on its conflict with Armenia over Nagorno-Karabakh?
Okay, let me, why don't we just hold that and let me let Richard Burt, the head of question, and see what Richard.
Yeah, Andrew talked about or made reference in his presentation to the customs union that Russia has with Belarus and Kazakhstan. But Andrew, unless I was asleep, you didn't talk about Putin's Eurasian Union initiative. And a couple of questions. First of all, what do you think is behind Putin's initiative? Is it principally geopolitical, or is it more economic, or both? But secondly, what has been the reaction of Turkey, Iran, and perhaps China to this initiative?
Okay. Any other questions on the at this point? Feel free to step up and use the microphone too, just because we are recording this for Andy. So Azerbaijan and the Eurasian Union. Do you want to start with the Eurasian Union? We're really
sure
focusing more on Central Asia today.
The latter part of the question was really, really good that I'm not really able to answer very well. You know, how has this actually been perceived by China, Iran, and Turkey? I haven't seen any significant Chinese commentary on the customs union or the Eurasian Union, and the customs union it's sort of the forerunner of, well, the analogy that the Russians use for the customs union is the development of the European community and the EU. And then it started with economic integration. And you start with it, you start effectively with a customs union, and then eventually you build up to more political integration as well. You have to have that with the economic integration. And that's how when the Russians talk to Westerners about it, that's how they talk about it. And a guy like Igor Shuvalov, who's often tasked to talk to Western audiences about Russian issues, as you know, he's made the argument at the time that basically the customs union we see is part of the larger Europe project for Russia, and that Russia, which is at the time when they first were talking about this, was much closer to WTO accession than, of course, did accede to the WTO last year. And that it would help to raise the norms and standards of other members of the customs union. Now, that would be great, but we'll see. Now, Kazakhstan is much closer than Belarus, like about 90% of the way, and Belarus is maybe 10 to 20% along the way. But that's one way it's been characterized. Now, another way it's been characterized I talked about is tied to China. And there was an interesting discussion that we had in Moscow as part of our U.S.-Russia-Japan trilateral meeting that Jeff was at in June of last year. And there was a very interesting and lengthy discussion about Asian regional integration institutions, economic and security. And after hearing a presentation from, I think, Ernie Bauer of CSIS about the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, very, very distinguished and savvy Russian economist turned to me and said, "Huh, so your TPP is the same goal basically as our Eurasian Union, i.e., how you kind of manage and deal with China and how help other states to manage with China's growing economic power." So I think that's a component to it that is not talked about by Russian leadership, obviously. I think it's one that the Chinese would obviously be very sensitive to. Mm. And the customs union and its impact, particularly on Kazakhstan and on the border trade of Chinese goods coming into Kazakhstan, is a problem. And that involves Kyrgyzstan as well. And it's hard to argue that the customs union is actually a net plus for Kazakhstan at this point. Most people would argue that it is economically, it has a negative effect overall on Kazakh growth, principally because of the impact that it has on the on China trade. We'll see how that goes. But the argument being that the Kazakhs, have joined the customs union more for political reasons than for economic reasons. Although there are political reasons that are tied to economic reasons as well, as some concern about being just kind of swamped by the Chinese economic behemoth.
On Azerbaijan, we might want to also, just one way to link it, if I could piggyback a little bit on Lisa's question, is this whole question of growing Iranian-Azeri tensions and obviously the way Iranian and Russian concerns about how Azerbaijan will play, what role it will play, as you talked about in terms of Trans-Caspian gas in particular and other energy. So I don't know if Tony would want to try that conversation.
The question I really have is, until you have an awful lot more time, what on earth would actually happen? You know, that we have all of these plans and all of these discussions and regional ambitions, but I think you kind of answered the question. Right now, they're concerned with themselves. Other people are irritated by them, and that's about it.
Andy, did you, or Jeff, did you?
The first point I would make is that, for all three of these states, their interests are much more significant in the Caucasus than they are in Central Asia. And the potential, not only the potential, but the actual reality of those interests conflicting is that much greater. And this is an oversimplification, but you kind of have, and Jeff actually wrote a great report for this, for a great CSIS, Russian Eurasia Program report that came out last year, looking at the big Caucasus. But one of the points in there is that this is kind of a schematic north-south axis of quasi-alliances with Russia, Armenia, and Iran, and then West, Turkey, Georgia, and Azerbaijan. Particularly the potential, I think, for Russian it was striking in the Georgia war when Erdogan, took a completely neutral position and said, look, this is, the United States is my most important security partner, and the Russian Federation is my most important economic partner. We're not taking sides. Huh, that's our NATO ally. I think when Steve and I were in Moscow a little more than a year ago, interviewing a lot of Russian academics and government officials, I think we clearly came away with the impression that the potential for Turkish-Russian conflict over economic and political issues is quite significant in the Caucasus, and the Russians have in the sense that, right now the Turkey's focused on the greater Middle East and their so-called, and they're very ambitious but likely to fail, zero problems foreign policy, and when that happens, then they're going to probably return to the Caucasus in ways that are going to be unpleasant for the Russian Federation, and in particular, it comes to Azerbaijan, where there are competing interests. Now, and obviously, competing interests between Azerbaijan and Iran. It was reported last year that Azerbaijan had agreed with the Israelis to be used as some kind of military platform for a strike on Iran. I remember we talked about this last spring when we presented the report, but I'm deeply skeptical that the Azeris would agree to that. They know that they're extremely vulnerable to any kind of Iranian retaliation that could be deeply hurtful. And frankly, I don't think the Russians would sign off on that either. But.
Yeah, just to round that out, just a moment, Dr. Liu, and just to round that out, apropos, the reason I think we sense this Russian concern about Turkey turning its attention back to the Caucasus because of the sense of limited reach and capacity into Central Asia, growing friction and problems in its engagement with a number of countries in the Eastern Mediterranean. So we're to turn some of its efforts. So that would be one of the linkages. But yes, Dr.
Lewis. Syria has taken all of space.
Yeah. Yet they've been managed. Yeah, right. But yet they've managed, although in the midst of all that, they certainly, and with the recent Erdogan visit to Turkey, that they've managed to compartmentalize that difference from the continuation of their economic and energy cooperation. So anyway, Dr. Liu, who's a visiting fellow here from
China. Actually, this morning I had a very in-depth discussion with Dr. Kotzman about the whole Iran thing. This discussion is about Russia, Iran, and Turkey, but eventually China, the China question arose at the Q&A session. So I'll give some comments. First, I think China has certain and even very big economic interest in both Iran and Afghanistan. And Afghanistan, and with the hot issue of the pivot, American pivot to Asia, I think China this year may strengthen its political relation with Iran as a counterbalancing act. I'm not sure, but I guess it's kind of the policy options of the Chinese government. And the second, I think China has economic interests. We have invested in Afghanistan. We need oil from Iran, and in the future there is a real need for protecting the economic interests, and this may include every option. And certainly, I'd say China has a very good relation with Iran, with both Iran and Pakistan. And we have a mechanism of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It's not a military and a political one. It's mostly an economic one. But I think it can play some political role in the future. So with such a mechanism, with China's relationship, with a good relationship with Iran and Pakistan and SCO, I think China may be at a better position than the United States to keep peace and stability in the future after the withdrawal of the American troops from Afghanistan. We don't know how much troops will be there after the withdrawal of the major troops, maybe 10,000. I think that's the maximum number I can imagine. So there is a question that in the future, no matter if the United States will keep some troops in Afghanistan, there is a question that how China should play its role in coordination with the United States. And lastly, I'd say something about what I heard before I came here a month ago. Actually, China has finished the training of several whole divisions, armed divisions, for the coin actions, the counter-insurgency actions in mountain areas. There's no announcement or what's the objective of this training, but we can imagine. So I think China is prepared to enter the area if the situation requires that. And on the cost side, that would be much, much, much cheaper than the U.S. entry, U.S. presence in that area. For China, it's only something like forward deployment of the army. That's much easier. Or at least I can say that's much less difficult for China to do that. So that's my comment.
Okay, thank you, Dr.
Thank Lin. You.
And you have had, of course, those exercises in the SCO context as well, right? But let me turn, I think, Andy Cutchins to Dr.
Well, Cutchins. I just want to, I appreciate your comments. Because I think, look, fundamentally, the United States and Russia and China, we have more common interests in security and stability of Afghanistan and the sort of greater Central Asian region. Ironically and unfortunately, this has been cast too often as this new great game and new competition. But the fact is that we know the Russians are concerned about this, and you just suggested we know the Chinese are concerned about what is going to happen after 2014. There's going to be, if not a security vacuum, then certainly a reduction of kind of the collective security with a significantly diminished U.S. presence. And I just I saw Matt Quimet was here. He's left. Something we've talked about many times, but we should really be talking very seriously, in Moscow and in Beijing about thinking about some kind of maybe division of labor is too strong of a word, but how do we manage this security of this region when we, the United States, are going to be, if not leaving, then certainly dramatically reducing our force presence there.
I think there were a couple other questions. I'm sorry, I just forgot which direction they came in from. Well, maybe we.
You guys can have the hot potato, Dr. Liu.
if I may.
Go ahead, Tony. I'm sorry.
I'm going to have to say that I think, having watched Iraq and Afghanistan, looking at the stability of the Central Asian countries, all of us need to be very, very careful about the idea we are managing anything and that we are going to bring stability from the outside to any one of these countries. We may be able to contain, influence, and limit the damage. The other thing that really bothers me is the tendency to talk about strategic potential as distinguished from what anybody is actually doing right now. Everybody has strategic potential. The fact of the matter is, most of the time it isn't realized, and most of the potential turns out to be far smaller than anybody states. And that particularly bothers me when we start talking about potential energy pipelines and large-scale movement of minerals. We need to run the numbers a lot more carefully, because most of this isn't going to happen for the next half decade at best. And most of these countries, and particularly I think Afghanistan, is going to be significantly unstable well after 2014, regardless of what any outside powers attempt.
Yeah, thanks. And maybe just to, apropos Andy's comment, just to draw the conversation a bit to a close here today, we entered this project thinking, in some ways, certainly influenced by some of this discussion about new great game in Central Asia and how would these two powers that were showing a greater interest and aspirations in the region, both Turkey and Iran, and having some significant interest, how might this play out? And I think what we found, and as you heard Dr. Menkov's comments about Turkey's desire to remain engaged, but really limited capacity, mostly in the economic sphere, in the security sphere, it has not really been a focus. And particularly, we didn't draw that point, but obviously, with the growing turbulence along its southern borders and the greater problems of much greater magnitude in the security realm closer to home, that's made it less effective. You heard Dr. Cordesman's comments about Iran as seeing this as, yes, important, but not such vital importance, and not likely to be heavily engaged unless there is a wider confrontation with the West in the Gulf and elsewhere, and that it would be somewhat opportunistic. Well, at the same time, still certainly concerned about the potential spillover effects and the continued instability in Afghanistan and elsewhere in the region, and the growth of Sunni extremist groups, drug trafficking, other things that have remained a problem. And then, of course, Russia still seeing and still having a lot of the levers, as Dr. Cutchins pointed out, in terms of shaping long-term developments. But clearly, and it was good that Dr. Liu raised the point, China certainly very active in the region, already the beneficiary of the one, as our colleague Ed Chow has oftentimes pointed out, the one pipeline, the gas pipeline out of Central Asia right now is heading east, not west, towards China. So clearly this will be an ongoing discussion about how China will play also in determining their region's future. So, sorry,
one last word.
I'm done.
China cannot be always a free rider. We have to pay something.
Yeah,
you're here.
Well, that is a sort of an ongoing debate. We go back to the call for a responsible stakeholder during the last administration, the first Bush administration, and. Still to be defined. Well, in any event, this has been a very interesting discussion, Stephanie. Thank you all for joining us. Just to give you, if you're interested in further reading, as sort of like the end of a good PBS story show, as I mentioned, Jeff Mankoff has a new report coming out on the U.S. and Central Asia that will be launched at an event here at CSIS on February 5th at 4 p.m. Also, as I mentioned earlier, Dr. Cordesman and his colleagues in the Burke Chair have just put out a major piece on U.S.-Iran strategic competition that was posted on our web last week and available there. And lastly, we do have a new sort of summary report of our Turkey-Russia-Iran Nexus project that's available in the latest issue of the Washington Quarterly, which is also posted online, looking at, right, by yours truly, that kind of summarizes our finding in this broader project. And as I said, we will be having at least one more seminar here and then a final report issuance in the end of March, or probably March 20th at this point is the date we're looking at. So hope some of you will join us for that, and thank you for your comments, and thank all of my colleagues today for their insights, and hope you'll join me in giving them a round of applause as well.